Bert. We're so lucky to have him here today. And since his whole anthology is about the ease and magic and rewards of making room for poetry, I think we should begin today with a poem. So Steve's going to read Diane or Melissa.
Let's start with Melissa.
Okay, he's going to read a poem by Melissa Range that's in the book and talk to you. Each poem in this book is accompanied by an essay, but he's going to just give you a kind of free-form version of that discussion. So thank you, Steph Burt.
Thank you for being here. As you may already know, a lot of this period is for questions. So if you've got questions about contemporary poetry, hang on to them and it won't be long. But we are going to read a couple of poems that Erica and I wanted to launch our discussion with. The Workhorse. His every hair and shred sheds two uses or more for our daily bread. Good sidekick, stock standby. He helps us tear the ground and haul the rye. Too much sweetgrass made him lame, or we did. Too much bridle made him tame, which we did. Nails in his foot mean he's not good for naught. Disease in the hoof, he's a no-shoe, no-show on the field. It's a no-go when he founders on the clock. He'll go free, barefooted, to the block. Bring me the workhorse. Bring me the pack mule, the breeder, the G-up whip-smart. I'll end their agony. Bring me the bedded-out racehorse, the pony petted and stunted that made money on the bit, stumping round a ring. Bring me the unfit, the falterer, the one who wouldn't take the halter, the bucker none could break. Bring me the tons of shoe iron, and may the miners leave the mine. Bring me the saddles and the reins, and may the cattle keep their skins. Workhorse, pale horse, ghost horse, dead to striving. Bring me the toil of the living that never rests, that after death still labors. Bones fixing glitter onto shiny paper. So that's Melissa Range, R-A-N-G-E, a poet who there's so much to like about, and a poet who's fairly early in her own career. That's from her first book, Horse and Rider, which I didn't think got the attention it deserved, but that might be easier to fix now that she's got a second book called Scriptorium, which is actually out right now from Boston's own Beacon Press, if there are Beacon Press people in the audience. But you might even be able to buy that here. I'm not sure what the pub date is. If not, look for it at Wellesley Books or wherever good books are sold. So Melissa Range is a poet who's doing a lot of things in that poem. One thing she's doing is that she's rhyming, and she's playing with and sometimes sticking to the most common meter for serious poetry in English from the late 1500s to about the 1950s, which is iambic pentameter. And she's not using the kind of pentameter that ninth grade English teachers hope their charges will recognize. It's not 10 syllables every time, going da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da, but she comes close to it and then she moves away from it. Bones fixing glitter onto shiny paper. If you like scanning things, that's actually, I think, a line of trochaic pentameter, which is a much weirder thing. But there's a strong pentameter norm there. He'll go free barefooted to the block. As we did, too much bridle made him tame. That's the norm. In the way that a lot of classical music tends to have 1, 4, and 5 as the chord you come back to. That's the norm. And that would not have been unusual for poetry in English in 1930, although modernism was around doing other things. It would not have been unusual for poetry in English in 1850. It's a little unusual now for someone who's younger than me. And one of the many things that I like about Melissa Range is that she's able to use all of those pre-modern tools of rhyme and scansion and meter in a way that's not just antiquarian, a way that's not boring, a way that is sort of aggressively contemporary. One of the ways that's aggressively contemporary is what she's doing rhythmically. It does go pretty far from that. Another way is her politics, and that is a deeply allusive poem, a poem that is deeply connected to many, many Bible texts, some of which I probably don't even recognize, and to many, many texts that are pieces of Americana, from Bring Me Your Tired, Your Poor, Your Huddled Masses Yearning to Breathe Free, which I hope some of you recognize in her Bring Me, Bring Me, to the pop singer Shira Warden, who's also called My Brightest Diamond, who is apparently part of the inspiration for this poem, as I discovered when I was writing about it, to 150 years of labor songs, because this is a union song. This is a poem about what do we do with our workers? What do we do with miners and blue-collar workers who feel abandoned, who have been abandoned by our inadequate systems of new parent leave, of sick leave, of medical care? It is a poem that's got tons and tons of text behind it, but it's also a poem that's quite a bit of advocacy. It's a protest poem. This workhorse that has been led to the block has behind it decades or centuries of union organizing, of poets who are extraordinarily literate trying to take the side of blue-collar workers. On one end of that is what's going on across the river with Harvard's dining hall workers. And far, far away on the other end of that, farther back in American history, is the history of abolitionism. Because this shackled and unshackled workhorse is also a distant descendant of not actual slaves who told their own stories in slave narratives so much as the slaves depicted, the enslaved people depicted in the stories told by, in particular, Christian abolitionist writers. And the last thing that sort of pops out about this poem, besides it's just its verbal density, the sounds in it, that I want to be sure everybody notices, is how deeply it is a Christian poem. Melissa Range is a poet of the Christian left. Melissa Range is a poet who's very interested in how the traditions that she comes from, which have to do with left evangelical Christianity in America, can help people from a lot of traditions work together and be more aware of what's going on in the language we hear and the lives that we live and with the polity that we inhabit. This horse who willingly and unwillingly gives himself up for a more materialist society and who is at the same time sacrificed and who ends up in our writings because bones turn into gelatin and glue and paper in Sunday school. This horse who gives himself up is an incarnation of the half-true, half-false promise that America makes to immigrants, an incarnation of a tradition of labor activism, but also literally an incarnation and making into new flesh of what Christian believers see in the sacrifice of the Son in the crucifixion. One of the many really old things that Melissa Range makes new, and one of the reasons I like having her be not the last, but one of the last poets in this book of 60 American poems since 1980, from all over the place, stylistically, thematically, emotionally, 60 American poems I really like, 60 poems that are relatively new, where I'm trying to help you read each one. One of the reasons I like having Melissa Range come near the end is that she makes so many old things new again.
And I would say one of the characteristics of all 60 of these poems, and Steve set out to publish 50 poems in this anthology.
Yeah,
one
it was
going to
be 50,
state,
yeah.
But there are way too many good ones. And in his introduction, he writes about the many that had to be left out. So in terms of just the open-minded, full embrace of American poetry right now, it's here. It's all in this book. And one of the things that this Melissa Range poem does that's so characteristic of your choices, I think, is that it has enormous surface effect at the same time that it's embodying and revisioning these historical traditions.
Yeah, all of the poems I like, if you approach them in the right frame of mind with the right sort of lens, sound great at first. They've all got surface appeal.
Yeah.
You know, T.S. Eliot said that great poetry can communicate before it is understood. And I don't always agree with Eliot, but I agree with that. But all of the poems that I chose and all the poems that I really like are poems where if you read them 20 times, you'll find something new that interests you, something more to like about them on time number 20.
Right, and it might be a single word that you realize is just flickering a different way.
It might be, yeah. And every time I come back to this, and I'm seeing things that I didn't see before. May the cattle keep their skins is a line I hadn't thought about a whole lot before.
Mm.
And what is that? What does that mean? It means we would like America to stop skinning its workers. It also means we don't need vellum, cowhide, right? Expensive, high-end paper to write down the truth of the Christian sacrifice, if you're Christian, or the truth that we are stronger together, to quote someone we've been hearing from a lot. That's not just an elite truth. We can write it down on regular paper.
Okay. I wanted to introduce Steve to you more formally for a second, Steph, because there's a wonderful self-description in the introduction to this book. It goes like this. A white Anglo 40-something writer and teacher with two genders, two kids, an expensive education, an adult life sponsored by university English departments, classical piano training, college radio experience, and a habit of reading comic books, buying comic books, even worse. He compares his role as a critic to that of being a cat. He drags things to the doorstep in whatever state of suspended animation and leaves them for you. You'll have this experience over and over and over again reading this book. And I think we should
keep having half-dead things brought to your door, yes.
At your doorstep, yeah. Or things that may seem to you half-dead when you first read them, but upon further examination, they get livelier and livelier and livelier. So we have Virgil in our midst. Let's not waste him. What poem could you read next? What would you like to do next? And if you have any poems, if you know this book and have poems you'd like to hear or questions about the nature of assembling this kind of anthology, we'll have time for Q&A later. But if you can't wait, just ask them now.
It is our hope that none of you own this book now and that you'll all own this book half in 45 minutes. So it's okay if you haven't read it. That's not expected. It just came out.
There's no quiz.
What I thought we would do, I'll pick one or two more to sort of toss at you. This is a capacious enough book, and I like sort of interactions enough. And I also, you brought in the cat analogy, which thank you. We are cat people.
Right.
Another analogy that I like to use for what does it mean to be a critic of contemporary poetry is radio DJs. When you're putting together a good radio show, or indeed a good variety show in another medium, you want a lot of stuff you like. You want a mix of the known and the unknown. You want a mix of fast and slow. You want a mix of loud and soft, probably. You want something where you like it all, and your listeners will like at least some or a lot of it, and stuff that will fit together and that will have some internal variety. And many DJs like requests. And one of the things that we can do, if there's something that you want to see, a form or a region of the country, or a demographic group that publishes poetry, or a topic, a thing that you want poetry about, you can actually request it, and we'll see whether I can come close to that with the 60 poems that are in here. And if not, I can actually recommend maybe a poet I like who you can go and read. But I'm actually happy to take requests of that kind in addition to, you know, is Jane Doe in here? You know, is Algernon Charles Swinburne in here? He's not. He died a while ago.
I just want to say one thing about liking.
Yeah.
You like a lot of poems.
I do.
He uses the word like. You talk about poems affectionately.
Thank you.
It's
yes.
So unusual.
Otherwise, why do this?
Yeah, precisely. But I think your just sheer affection for poetry is just very rare and very enticing.
Oh. Thank you. Yeah, I've been accused of liking everything, which is really not true. Like, if I had the same taste and a different personality, I could list, you know, the 20 most overrated American poets. Let's do that. No,
later.
No. There's a lot of poetry out there where I don't like it. Some of it I see why other people like it. Some of it I feel like it's sort of a little fraudulent, but I don't want to go there because there's so much work that I do like. Some of which is by people who are already very famous, and some of which is by people who I would like to be famous and they're not. Or at least to have more fans. I had I don't know if who reads The New Republic here, the magazine The New Republic. Yeah, it's great now. Kathy Park Hong's the poetry editor. Jeet here is doing political commentary. It's a terrific, fun sort of left, center-left lit in politics magazine. A few years ago, the prose style was still beautiful, but it had a rather different take on America. And there was a terrific sort of book critic named Adam Plunkett, who wrote a very long piece about how he didn't like me. It was really fun, and it sort of understood exactly what I was trying to do as a critic, and then said that this was not worth doing. But it called me poetry's greatest fanboy. And the boy thing I had some problems with, but the fan stuff? You know, I would like to be poetry's greatest fangirl. And to, you know, participate in debates. But yeah. Yeah, I prefer to talk about things that I like. And why don't I read you, we talked about the Diane Glancy poem.
Sure.
So Diane Glancy actually brings up something else that's worth talking about with this stuff. When you write about poets from classical antiquity or, you know, poets from Shakespeare's time, you will never meet them in person. You will never do an event with them. Hi, I should mention Erica's own poetry. You should go out and read it. Do you want to name some of your own titles so that... That your most recent book of your own poetry is?
Earthly. Out of print.
Okay. Is it out of print?
Yeah, it is out of print.
Oh, I'll find it. and another one soon. But when you work on contemporary poetry, especially if you also write poetry yourself, and if you write both write for newspapers as well as for books, and you sort of do live events, and you've been doing it for more than 5 minutes, you have to start thinking about conflicts of interest. And you have to think about, when do I know someone too well to write about them? What happens when you've met someone? And for my general rule was, if I met you because I liked your work, then you're in. If I met you and then started to like your work, then you don't go into the book, even though I might interview you or do something else to promote your work, which I like. And I left a couple of my favorite poets of my own generation out of this book because I knew them quite well before they were writing the work that I admired. I thought that was just, like, not cool. I should in particular say you should all go buy Monica Youn's book, Blackacre, Youn. It is one of the best books of poetry to come out this year. I think the pub date was like 2 weeks ago. We've known each other for a while, and we have the same poetry publisher, and it was clearly, she couldn't be in here, but I wish she could. But Diane Glancy, who is someone who I taught alongside for a few years in Minnesota, but she's not someone of my own generation, and she's someone who writes about things that I'm not otherwise familiar with. Her background's very unlike mine, and I came to the work, and then I came to her. And so I felt okay about putting Diane Glancy's poetry in this book. And I used a poem she's been publishing since the late 80s. What page is she on? She's been publishing since the late 80s, but she started publishing somewhat late. And she came to the poetry world after having been a mom and been someone who was in sort of a non-elite part of Missouri and Oklahoma. And she identifies as Cherokee, and a lot of her work is connected to Native American identity or to Cherokee identity or to sort of Midwestern Cherokee identity. And when you write about her in the context of Native American poetics, you discover that she anticipated a lot of things that are going on with Native American poetics right now with first books, with writers younger than me, with writers who were too young to sort of go into this book even, but who are going to be, who are emerging.
They'll be in the next
book. They might be in the next book. Yeah, people like Layli Long Soldier, who I really like, which is Diane Glancy is not writing for an oral tradition. She's not writing a poetry that is meant to be understood by all and only the people who have her tribal affiliation. She's not replicating oral rituals. She's not a performance poet. She's writing extremely demanding work, work that's indebted to the American avant-garde of the 70s in some ways. Because she's trying to figure out what she can and can't say as someone whose relationship to the land and to her own traditions is complicated. Complicated because she has a very skeptical personality. Complicated because she is, as most of us are, part of an industrial civilization. Complicated because if you're Cherokee, you don't mostly want to talk about how your people have been in the same place for generations and generations and generations because you know, genocidal or quasi-genocidal white people with guns made everybody move hundreds or thousands of miles a couple generations ago. On the other hand, you might draw, as she does draw, from non-Western or non-European or localized or sort of pan Native American traditions, ways of thinking about non-human animals and ways of thinking about presence on the land and ways of thinking about whether our language that we are using now, and for her as for me, that language happens to be English, is surprisingly like and surprisingly unlike the sounds and the communications and the connections to an ecosphere that non-human animals use. And in this case, that non-human animal is a crow. And the poem, which I'm about to read you, has Diane Glancy listening to and wondering how she is like and is able to hear the sounds that a crow makes in the tall grass of a tall grass prairie. But the title isn't about crows. It's about the weirdness of trying to use language to do something that doesn't happen every day, that's not conversational, that pushes back against cliché. One of the clichés she's pushing back against is the idea that a poet is a hawk with a hawk's eye or an eagle eye who sees everything at once. Another idea is she's pushing back against clichés about Native people. The cliché, for example, of Native people with tomahawks. If you're from Oklahoma, Missouri, if you live in Minnesota, if you've lived in Iowa, you've encountered sort of these offensive college football mascots, right? Right. I'm from Washington, D.C., so I grew up with one of the most offensive ones. What do you do if you're going to take all those cliches and all those mistakes about Native identity and mash them together and attack them and go beyond them? You coin a word that's never been heard before and is never going to be used against. You take the hawk, and you take the awkwardness, and you take talking, and you take the tomahawk, and you smash them together, and you have a nunce word. And so Diane Glancy's poem, which I'm about to read you, is called Hamatalk. Hamatalk. Just it was, crow-tongued, he was saying a caw. Then wings fold up the Indian, if antlers deer give up totems of the head, the anyhow of them. This coat gets smaller each year, like the teepee I come from when I back to the space I was born. The small ho-hum of it. Old ones all reversed, smaller, the autumn trees than I remember. The way old language breaks. Hum way, to hum hum, the buzzled wiggle of the tall grasses smoothed down by the path of them to woods through the field. I'm going, And if not, I come back smaller. Then he, the crow, sings like this. His mouth he opens. Caw, caw. The grasses wave. They take flight. The crow wings. Grasses burnt. All fields shrivel. Next, the new world. I hope you can hear both the way that she's trying to get this attachment to the land and to non-human nature that many of us think of as a goal, not only but often of native poetics, and the really caustic ironies in there. The new world. Who calls it the new world? Right? For whom is this world new? What's new?
And there's the iambic again, the way old language breaks. You know, it could be Thomas Campion.
Yeah. All do not all things well. It could be Thomas Campion, yeah.
Yeah. It's this poem, too, is so, it's illustrative of what is so characteristic of the book, which is that there's just no one school in it. You found a lot of poets who have said, I don't label me, I don't want to be an eco-poet, I don't want to be modern, postmodern, post-postmodern, I don't want to be a language poet, I don't want to be a religious poet, I just want to be able to encompass all of myself in my
work.
Well,
and even the ones who are happy with labels, the labels are multiple, and there's really not one label you can put on, many or most of these poets, even though some of the individuals are quite happy to be Midwestern poets or African-American poets or poets who use rhyme or language poets.
Mm-hmm.
I want to be sure we get all the time that we have for audience questions. I'm very comfortable talking and talking. I'm too comfortable talking and talking. I like interaction. I'm not wearing a watch. I'm wearing a hand brace.
Yeah, it's arm brace time.
It's arm brace time. It's Q&A time. Did you have
why don't we hear one more poem? Is that all right? Let's hear another poem.
Okay.
And
want to do a short one?
Sure.
Want to do the Massey? Ashbery? Okay.
Ashbery?
Sure. Yeah. Joseph Massey's terrific.
Okay, here's the challenge to doing Ashbery. And I love that this book begins with Ashbery because Ashbery is where so many people stop reading poetry, right? They say, cut, not going after that. And
he's really good.
And he's terrific. And this poem is it seems as simple as a nursery rhyme after you hear the discussion of it in this book.
Okay.
So
okay,
we'll end.
Yeah, this is another thing about putting this book together is that most of these poems are not familiar to you if you're not already someone who reads contemporary poetry all the time, which is fine. Otherwise, there would be no reason to write the book if they were all sort of famous to everyone. But if you are someone who reads contemporary poetry all the time, some of the poems will be very familiar, and some of them, I hope, will be very new to you. And this is one of the ones that, if you're in that sort of headspace already, will be very familiar. And I like to use classical music analogies. I assume there are sort of composed music listeners in here. There are people who've never heard the Moonlight Sonata before, right? There are people who've never heard, like, Ravel String Quartet. But if you go to a lot of string concerts, you know Ravel String Quartet, I hope. I sort of came to it as an adult, and people know that one. So some of these poems have kind of that position, and I can use other musical analogies also, like the first Nas album or something if you're a rap person. So this is a poem that's very familiar if you're in this field already, and I want everyone to read it because I love it, but it was a little hard to find things to say about it that were new, but I think I did, and one of the things, and I'm going to get to the poem in a second, one of the things about it is that it is an introduction, a playful, I hope, tricky introduction to the kind of poetry that it also represents, which is a kind of poetry that wants to speak directly to you and to describe your life for you and also to keep you on your toes. And it's John Ashbery's 16-line poem called Paradoxes and Oxymorons. And it's where the book title comes from, too. This poem is concerned with language. That's my hat. This poem is concerned with language on a very plain level. Look at it talking to you. You look out a window or pretend to fidget. You have it, but you don't have it. You miss it. It misses you. You miss each other. The poem is sad because it wants to be yours and cannot. What's a plain level? It is that and other things, bringing a system of them into play. Play? Well, actually, yes, but I consider play to be a deeper outside thing, a dreamed role pattern, as in the division of grace these long August days without proof, open-ended, and before you know, it gets lost in the steam and chatter of typewriters. It has been played once more. I think you exist only to tease me into doing it on your level, and then you aren't there or have adopted a different attitude, and the poem has set me softly down beside you. The poem is you. And come on in and sit down. There's seats. This is a poem that says a lot about the history of poetry. It has a kind of romantic attachment to nature and a sort of personal feeling, and then it gets into the steam and chatter of typewriters, modernism. But it's also about how we read poems in general, about the way that any poem, once you get to love it, whether it seems transparent at first or whether it seems quite opaque, is at once trying to speak to you to get you to be part of the universe of feeling that the poem contains, and is trying to bring you something that's weird and different that you wouldn't have gotten to. And that's one of the things that this playful, tricky Ashbery poem, full of paradoxes, statements that are true and not true at the same time, or oxymorons, self-canceling statements, one of the things that this poem is trying to put forward for us. I hope we can take it.
And it's so unalienated.
I hope.
Yeah.
I hope.
It is
okay. Q&A time, right?
Yeah.
Let's have some cues.
Questions.
Yeah. Requests. We take requests. Hi, yeah.
I don't know what a language poet is.
Yes. Yes, I can. So, do you want the ultra short version or the couple long sentences version? Okay. So put yourself back, some of you were reading poetry then and some of you didn't exist then, to the early 1970s, when the Vietnam War is going on and there's a lot of activity on various kinds of the left, cultural and political, and there are a lot of poets who really want to write poems that oppose the Vietnam War and support the hippies or support socialism or make the country better. And these poets are often writing poems that seem to be very transparent, that seem to speak for stones and bones and animals and the Grateful Dead, and maybe they smoke weed, maybe they don't. They're poems that are trying to be very organic and natural and just speak from the heart. And the people who we now call language poets were people who began to write in the late 60s and early 70s, and they were on the left, and they were avid readers of political and literary theory, and they wanted to do something new, and they wanted to support the left, and they didn't like the war, but they also didn't like all of the, let's bring those troops home now, ho, ho, Ho Chi Minh, I speak from the heart with my gonads poetry that they saw being written around them. They thought it was sexist, or naive, or unreflective, or not interested in their ideas, or just boring. And so they wanted to write poetry that really resisted prose sense. Some of them thought that ordinary prose sense, New York Times newspaper prose, was colluding with capitalism. Some of them just thought it was boring, they didn't want more of it. They wanted to write poetry that was demanding, that was challenging, that was kind of like 12-tone music if you're a classical person, if you're a composed music person. That was kind of like abstract painting if you're a gallery art person, but that wasn't about the great individual ego and what it had to say. They wanted to write poetry that was skeptical and challenging and weird and questioned everything. And they did this as a group and as individuals for the 70s and for the 80s, and eventually they got noticed by English departments, especially English departments that were really into literary theory. And they, some of them have kept on writing. They have had descendants, just like 12-tone composers have descendants, just like challenging gallery artists have descendants. Often they're people who have, who seem to have developed cults around them, but some of them are really inspiring. And the best of them, to my taste, have been able to combine those anti-voice, anti-romantic, skeptical, challenging, intellectual, and also political left goals with the things that older poetry has been able to do about giving you a sense of an individual who has emotions and an inner life, who reacts to what's going on around her. The people from who are now called language poets, and they got that name from a magazine that was called L equals A equals N equals G equals U equals A equals G equals E, in all caps. If you've ever had to type that, you sort of hate having to type it. But that's where the name came from. They published in L equals in that magazine. The ones who became the most famous as critics and as literary theorists are not necessarily my favorites. My very favorite person to come out of that movement is Ray Armantrout, who's got a new selected poems this year. But there are a number of other good ones. Lynn Higinian, certainly worth reading. Carla Harriman, who writes plays and very strange prose poems. She's in there.
Mm-hmm.
That's who the language poets or language writers were. And the ones who were the most polemical and sort of silly seemed to be attacking all of the other kinds of poetry in existence and saying, we're the only way forward, in a way that 12-tone composers used to do. And that was kind of stupid. But they were correct in thinking they'd invented new, difficult, fun, challenging ways of writing that were connected to literary theory in complicated ways. And that's who the language writers were. And, you know, are still around. Yeah. Ah, yes. Funny you should ask me that. Bob Dylan's a great songwriter. Songwriting in our time is not the same thing as what I usually call poetry. It was much closer to what I usually call poetry in other times and places, because the meaning of the word poetry has changed. Not entirely, but at the margins. So I don't like it when people call him a great poet, but as the poet Matthew Zapruder said when this was announced, it's not the Nobel Prize for page-based or book-based poetry or for poetry. It's the Nobel Prize for literature, right? Bob Dylan uses words in the ways that are beautiful and meaningful and original and durable and influential. It happens that for those words to do what they're supposed to do, you have to have some music behind them. We also, I think, the Nobel Prize has been given to playwrights. Generally, playwrights, you have to have a live actor on a stage and sets and props, right? I have no problem with it. I sort of dislike the who should have gotten it instead vibe, because to really know who should get a Nobel Prize in literature, you have to be able to read more languages than like almost anyone can read, right? Mm-hmm. Like, I don't know what's going on in Sumatran. I don't even know what's going on in Arabic, which is sort of sad. I wish I read Arabic. I do not. So I don't know who should have gotten it. I think Bob Dylan's great. I think giving the Nobel Prize to a songwriter is fine. I think he's doing something different than the poets who are in this book, but so are playwrights and so are novelists and so are, you know, essayists. Mm. So
but the thing about these poems, Steve, is there's so much music on the page, right?
Well, music is a weird word
it
to
is
use,
a weird,
right?
Yes.
I hope that all of these poems are really sonically interesting. If music just means they sound great, I hope they sound great.
Yeah.
They don't have chord progressions or melodies,
mm-hmm.
Because they don't need them.
Right.
And even when you go back to Thomas Campion's time,
mm-hmm.
to 1615 or 1587, to a time when lyric poetry was much more connected to singing, even then you see some distinction between poets who are really writing to be written and to be read, and poets who are writing to be sung. Shakespeare's sonnets are not designed to be sung, although people have set them to music. And the sonnet, which is at the core of what we think of as lyric poetry sometimes nowadays, evolved as a way of writing poetry that wasn't for singing.
Right, right.
Yeah.
It came more from dance, really.
Sonnets? How did sonnets come from dance?
From the, I thought from the patterns.
Sonnets have patterns.
Yeah.
And dances have patterns.
Yes.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. All art forms have patterns, yeah. Yeah. Cool. That is a good question. I occasionally teach high school age students, but mostly I teach older students, college age and grown up. So I feel like I'm not sure what I know that you don't know.
Mm.
Do you want your colleagues at your high school to teach poetry in their classrooms, or do you want them to enjoy poetry at home?
Can you invite poets to your high school?
No. Yeah, that's, yeah.
Lots of them will come for nothing.
Well, if you have a budget, you'll please pay us.
Right, you'll be surprised.
If you have a budget, please pay us. This book is designed to help you do that. I hope it helps. It's got sort of, not literally something for everyone, but something for a lot of different people, including a couple poems that have devoted young readers. And I would say if you can share with your colleagues the fact that your students are responding to the poetry, that they're engaged. Teaching poetry to young readers is so much easier than teaching novels because if you're teaching a text that's 12 lines long, nobody's going to come to class and say, you know, I didn't do the reading. The problem for college teachers as well, right? I don't. If you're teaching Middlemarch, right? Great book. They don't always read it.
Right.
But you
have time in class to read it, to read the poems.
Right, but you don't for Middlemarch, right?
Right.
So just sharing with your colleagues the fact that this has been pedagogically effective for you, and the fact that there's poetry out there that speaks to so many concerns. It's a great time to be a young reader. There's so much going on right now with the merger of performance poetry and page-based poetry that's going on right now with people like Sam Sachs and Ocean Vuong, for that matter. There's so much going on with people younger than me about the evolution of ways of writing and hearing poetry that's new. More specific advice would depend on, honestly, what your classes are like and what the high school is. Because there's one set of things I'd say for teaching poetry at, what's a good example, like Commonwealth or something, or Concord Academy. And there's one set of advice that I would give for teaching poetry at a school with much larger classes and students who have other challenges. If you have a lot of students who are maybe new Americans, or a lot of students where they're not already sort of big readers, their parents maybe aren't big readers, where you start is different. And I would say in terms of it sounds like you already know what they should be reading. It's just that your colleagues aren't reading the things that your students are reading. Mail them all a selected Lucille Clifton. Just publicize with other grown-ups the fact that your students are responding to what you are teaching them. Because they're maybe... is this helpful?
Mm.
Yeah. The other thing is that YouTube is your friend here. Performance poetry is a thing that's continuous with page-based poetry more than it is a competitor to page-based poetry. And I wouldn't have said that 15 years ago.
And make use of the Mass Poetry Festival.
Oh, yeah.
If you don't already go there.
Yeah, well, that's in Salem.
Yeah.
Yeah, you can bring your colleagues to Salem.
Going on. Yeah.
Even you can bring your colleagues to Salem even if you can't bring your students. Hi, other questions? Yeah.
Uh-huh.
I have a fifth grader.
Uh-huh.
There are black poets who do not do any engagements in February for that reason, and I've heard that. Yeah. 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 You sound like your students are already on it. It's just your colleagues. Yeah. You guys should talk. Yeah. I hope you'll talk after the event. Are there? I want to be sure we get other questions.
Yeah. I don't see any more.
If we. Yeah. Czesław Miłosz, Polish. Hungarian poetry is great, but he's Polish, yeah. Oh, sure. Yeah. So that's a wonderful poem. That's another one of these poems that, at least if you're from a sort of certain poetry space, it's Little Moonlight Sonata-y, it's one of the classics, at least for me. It's
61.
My love.
Steve.
Thank you. Poetry in translation is important. It's been important to every generation of American poets, and it's generated sort of intercultural masterpieces, poems that are really good as poems in English. And I wanted to have one, and you know, only one poem that was a translation. There's other poems later in this book, Brandon Somm's poem, for example, which is deeply engaged with questions of translation. But this is a poem that is a translation. And it's a translation in it that also represents a poet I like a lot who's not in the book in other ways, which is Robert Pinsky. Who is he here? No. Mm. Okay. He lives around here, as you may know. So I'm glad to be able to have Robert Pinsky's work in here. I think it's among his great achievements. And I really like Miłosz. I think Miłosz has a lot to teach us. Yeah, this is also a poem that's one of those poems that got reprinted and circulated after 9/11, and it sort of represents a little bit people wanting poetry to do public work of consolation after disasters. And it's actually, I guess it's timely again, given what's in the news and given the unreasonability. The irrationality of a lot of what's in the news. And this is a poem that was written in reaction to a moment that was even grimmer for some people than our own, which is the failure of the Prague Spring, the moment of 1968, when on the one hand, you have the Soviet Union crushing dissent and crushing what could have been a really wonderful sort of democratic socialism in what was then Czechoslovakia. And then on the other hand, if you're Miłosz, who's, you know, a little bit older than me, right? He died, I think, in his 90s, not that long ago. And you see the irrationalism that's part of 1968. Not just the assassinations and the obviously terrible stuff, but the sense that the young are about rejecting the past and about rejecting scholarship. That disturbed him too.
Before you read it, may I say something? Because I think then we're going to have to stop after you read it. But I want to end with your voice and Milosha's voice. But
okay.
Just so you all know, their books are for sale outside.
Yeah.
And Steve will be here to sign them for you, too.
Yes.
So
will I be physically here or at the back?
You'll be physically there. Well, you can be physically as many places as you want.
I can't. I can only be in one place at once.
But let's... It's where?
Where?
Right
back.
There.
Okay, great.
In this room. Yeah. In
and,
this
and,
very
and by
room.
Buying books today, even if you buy mine, you can support Wellesley Books, support the book festival, and support you know independent literature in many, many ways.
Right.
So Milosz is reacting to this moment of large, scary rallies and Russian aggression and a scary moment about the future of civilization and democracy and reading in 1968. Robert Pinsky translates the poem in the early 80s, and it circulates again a lot after 9/11, and it's beautiful, and that's why it's in here, and I'm going to read it to you. Incantation, translated from the Polish by Robert Pinsky and Czesław Miłosz. Human reason is beautiful and invincible. No bars. No barbed wire, no pulping of books, no sentence of banishment can prevail against it. It establishes the universal ideas in language and guides our hand so we write truth and justice with capital letters, lie and oppression with small. It puts what should be above things as they are. Is an enemy of despair and a friend of hope. It does not know Jew from Greek or slave from master, giving us the estate of the world to manage. It saves austere and transparent phrases from the filthy discord of tortured words. It says that everything is new under the sun, opens the congealed fist of the past. Beautiful and very young are philosophia and poetry, her ally in the service of the good. As late as yesterday, nature celebrated their birth. The news was brought to the mountains by a unicorn and an echo. Their friendship will be glorious. Their time has no limit. Their enemies have delivered themselves to destruction.
Amen. Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you for running
thank
this.
You.
Thank you, Erica. Thank you to everybody at the book festival, and thank you to this church for hosting literature. And thank you.